Case number 21-2887, Kavanta McLilly versus Noah Nagy. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Mainprise Hajek, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jessica Mainprise Hajek on behalf of Kavanta McLilly. I'd like to save 5 minutes for my rebuttal, if I may.
Sure.
Your Honors, this case comes before you today as Kavanta McLilly was convicted after trial by jury in Genesee County of assault with intent to murder, armed robbery, felon in possession, and felony firearm. Now, our two main arguments and issues with Mr. McLilly's, our main issue with Mr. McLilly's trial is that the trial came down to credibility. Herein, we had no physical evidence, no DNA, and we had a defendant who took the stand on his behalf saying, this wasn't me. I went into a store, bought some items, left. We have a co-defendant with substantial motive to lie, substantial bias, saying, Mr. McLilly put me up to this. We have that identification. We have two individuals who weren't charged but with also motive to lie saying, this is the guy that put me up to going into the store.
You're talking about the three young people?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The juveniles. We have the one co-defendant that was actually charged, the other two that were not. I think it's important to note that there's nothing in the record indicating that the two juveniles, Watkins and Reeder, not the co-defendant, had previously even seen or identified Mr. McLilly at all. They never testified previously, and that's on the record at trial. We have surveillance video from the gas station where Mr. Singh, the victim in the case, was brutally shot, and ultimately the store was robbed. That had a purple hue to it. It was difficult to distinguish the different clothing colors or different colors in general, and we had an expert that testified as to his enhancement that he made on this video. We have Mr. Singh, who testified that the assailant, the person that shot him, was masked. But yet he was still 100% that he could ID the person that injured him, that assaulted him, that attempted to murder him.
Well, wasn't the individual in the video wearing the same clothing that, it wasn't their testimony that it was the same clothing that your client was wearing earlier when he came to the store?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. That is the testimony that it was the same clothing. However, we would submit and argue that the record shows that the video, we have these officers that were testifying as to surveillance video, didn't have any personal knowledge, surveillance video that was ultimately entered into evidence, saying that the clothing is a coat in December, a black coat, jeans, and brown shoes. So this identical clothing, I think, is...
And wasn't he also wearing those shoes at the hearing also?
That's what they contended down at preliminary exam, that he was wearing the same shoes, but I would note, and it's in the record, that at district court, the preliminary exam, they actually took those shoes and tried to test it for DNA to see if there was anything on it. All to no avail. There was nothing. So there was an allegation, or the government believed that it may be the same shoes. But again, when you're dealing with a winter in Michigan, we have a black coat, jeans, brown shoes, very amorphous, individuals with masks.
It's like, yeah, they were driving a blue Chevy, you know. Oh, okay. pretty common.
And that's the argument. Also, when it comes to the surveillance, they're talking about a blue Chrysler 300, whereas Mr. McLilly, in his defense, testified that it was, in fact, black. So the entire issue when it comes to these two officers with the authority of the badge behind them looking at the jury and invading their province and saying, that's your guy. That's the guy that did this. That's the guy that shot.
So your argument really comes down to, it looks to me in the cross-examination it was brought out that the officers only had, the only basis of their testimony was that the fact that they had reviewed this video. I think that's clear.
Correct.
So the jury knew that.
Correct.
So it seems like your argument is the fact that they were officers and gave the testimony, that's the critical point. Because the jury had all the facts to know what the basis for the officer's testimony was, which was that they had reviewed a video, and the jury got to review the same video. So I guess it seems to me that's your argument, that because they're officers that makes it special, therefore there's a taint.
I'd agree in part. I agree that it's Absolutely. These are officers. There's necessarily a taint. You have the government.
But what other taint would there be besides that?
The invasion of the province of the jury. And
but
yes,
the jury has all the same facts.
True.
To make their own decision.
True. But when you have a police officer, as the court stated, when you have a police officer that is saying, this is the guy, too, as a matter of fact, and then I believe the officer in charge, Petrick, testified not quite the exact same, but similarly, that these minors were truthful when they came and spoke to me, et cetera, et cetera. You have a witness with the badge behind them saying, and regardless of the fact that the jury got to view the video, we know that the video had its difficulties. We know that the video had its, I believe there was testimony by Detective Sergeant Tomasi, the expert, that he had to enhance it. He had to use filters, et cetera. So with that, I believe that the officers testifying and the government testifying that this is the guy necessarily taints and invades the province of the jury. So yes.
And so your argument is that it is a constitutional violation.
Correct.
For a police officer to testify as to what is on a video.
As to an identification, I believe that there's clear case law that if you have an officer that observes a defendant for a substantial amount of time, that has some sort of knowledge, et cetera, to the basis of this identification, it's not just that they watched the video, it's that they pointed to Mr. McLilley and said, this is the guy, this is the shooter, we're not making any mistakes here, et cetera. So
I think that what Judge Bitley's, is it always a constitutional violation for an officer to improperly testify in that manner? Or do you need more to say it's a due process violation?
I think every case is obviously fact-specific. I don't know if it would always be, but in this instance, with the fact that, I mean, is it a constitutional violation? Yes, I would argue, absolutely. But then you obviously have the analysis afterwards, whether or not it had a substantial and injurious effect or influence. And in this instance, when we are dealing with the credibility, the lack of actual physical evidence, DNA, anything of that nature, and a victim who identified based on a mask and the bias of the other identifications, that it absolutely rises to a level where...
I don't really know what bias there was, I mean, necessarily for the other three. I mean, one of the young men goes... I mean, I'll be candid with you. The other three witnesses, the young men... I think are your biggest obstacle here in saying that the officer's testimony was harmful under Brecht. I mean, you have three young men who say that McLilley came to them and asked them to do this, you know, scheme to drop a bottle, and then one of them does it, and then McLilley, you know, supposedly goes in there, but they identify him. He says that he talked to them, right? And so he's not wearing a mask when he talked to them. And one of them, so far as bias goes, I mean, one of them went straight to the police, right, and was not charged. So is there a bias for that person?
I believe that there's bias for all three. Obviously, the co-defendant who has charges, but you do have the conflicting testimony wherein, and I believe it was cross-examined quite extensively by trial counsel, that all of these individuals, all three juveniles, came to the police and gave the same story to begin with. And that was that Mr. McLilley walked by and they wanted to know, hey, do you want to buy some weed? So you have three juveniles who, one, charged with a very serious offense. Two, there was information in the record that they were in school and they were playing basketball. They had a coach. And I think the stigma when it comes to the reality of what Mr. McLilley testified to, these kids were out there selling weed. and their parents know it, their teachers know it, et cetera.
I mean, so, you drive down the Michigan Highway these days, you know, and like everybody's selling weed.
Agreed. I can't drive down Genesee County without, in yeah. Genesee County without seeing four or five dispensaries.
Yeah, Genesee County in particular, everywhere. It's like every billboard.
Anyway, true.
I'm sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No. That's actually a very valid point. But back in 2012, that wasn't the case.
True.
I believe that
okay.
is my time.
You'll have your full rebuttal.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Eric Jenkins on behalf of respondent. What petitioner is attempting to do is spin a clear-cut state law evidentiary issue into one of constitutional magnitude.
Well, it could be a constitutional issue if it rendered the trial fundamentally unfair, right?
That's true, and that's why I'm going to jump straight to the facts that the court has been asking about today. I think the
let me just add, I mean, just up front, just housekeeping, narrow the range of dispute. I mean, you agree, as I understand it, that the officer testimony was improper. It should not have been permitted to opine based on the same video that the jury can look at. You know, offer his whatever opinion that McLilly is the guy in the video. Do you agree with that?
Under the state rule of evidence, yes, at least as okay. to one of the officers. I believe the first officer to testify, there may be some debate about that officer, what they opined to. I know a lot of the discussion, a lot of the testimony was about wearing the same clothes and things like that. The second officer
right.
definitely gets into calling the person on the video the defendant many times. But that's under state law that we agree it's an error.
Okay.
As a constitutional violation, we do
that's
not
a different
agree.
Question.
It
sure.
is a different question.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the facts are what matter here to demonstrate why it's not a constitutional violation, and then if this court were to find something along those lines, why any error here is harmless.
What could be a constitutional violation? Maybe that's a bad question, but, I mean, if you're saying this is not, then is there, can an officer testify as to anything on a video in any instance and get away with it under the Constitution?
No, I don't know if that's true. They can get away with anything under the Constitution. I know the appellant has cited Cooper as some evidence to suggest there may be a situation where an officer has gone too far. But I think that case, one, is distinguishable from this case, and that officer said, looking at all the evidence, everything pointed to the defendant as the guilty party. Secondly, that case was pre-AEDPA. And it flipped not only on that issue, but also on cumulative error, which the Supreme Court has not said is a basis for habeas relief. But I think going back to the facts of this case, and I think some of the court's questions highlight some issues with what appellant is arguing here. First of all, the boots, I believe Judge Bush, you mentioned these boots, these brown boots. What's important to remember about that evidence, though, is it was physical evidence. The boots were seized at the preliminary examination. So the petitioner wore those boots to the preliminary examination. The investigating officer, Detective Petrick, I believe is how you pronounce his name, noticed it, had the boots seized, and then those boots were submitted at trial as an exhibit and a picture from the robbery of the perpetrator wearing boots was submitted for the jury to look at. So again, the jury has all the facts here. They have the boots, they have the picture, and they can make that comparison. Secondly, the Chevy was mentioned, and I understand that it's contended that the video is not that great and that there's blue versus black and Chevy in Michigan in winter. A lot of people drive Chevys. But the key about that, though, is that all three of the juveniles testified that they saw the appellant in that in a Chevy or in a car. He was asking them questions about going inside. You want to make some money? Could you go inside and drop a bottle? One of them testified that he told them to get the clerk from out behind the counter. Then all three testified that the individuals they saw get out with guns got out of the same car as the one that the appellant was in asking those questions. So video aside, you have three witnesses who are saying he was in that car, that's the car the assailants got out of. So again, I think that's important evidence for identification, for showing that this person was involved in this robbery, and then leading to at least a inference that this person was the one who went into the store. Again, I point back to the boots that were worn as another independent evidence of identification showing that this was the person, the appellant was the person committing the robbery in this case. Also, the basis of the identification, even of the officers who did give this opinion, specifically the first officer, when he's testifying, he's not out of the blue saying that is the defendant on the video there. He gives a basis for the identification. The basis for the identification is he says, We have this person who comes into the store initially, which Mr. McLilly admits is him. A photo of that person was put out on the news, and an anonymous tipster came out of the woodwork and said, that's Mr. McLilly. That was compared to an SOS photo or a driver's license photo of Mr. McLilly. Those were all submitted to the jury for their consideration.
There were two videos. There was the video from the initial entrance and the video from the robbery?
Yeah, my understanding is that the entire video was shown, and at least still shots from each part of the transaction were shown to the jury. So there's photos of Mr. McLilly coming into the gas station initially without a mask on. Mr. McLilly is confronted with that, I believe, by his own counsel during trial and admits, yeah, that's me. He disputes whether or not he's the person with the mask on later. But then the jury is given still shot photographs of the person coming in with the mask. And again, going back to the basis of the first officer's testimony, he testified that he believed it was Mr. McLilly the second time because they were wearing the same clothing. And again, the second time would be when he comes in with a mask on and with a gun in his hand and
so
robs.
Where are the three young men situated at the time that the masked gunman goes back in?
They're outside the gas station.
So they're kind of still just hanging around?
Hanging around. They see, one. I believe the testimony is pretty consistent across the board with all three of them. Once they see individuals jump out of the car, one of which they saw was armed, they took off running.
Yeah.
So they're not in the actual gas station when the robbery occurs. There is another witness who's in the gas station who does see the two masked men, but he's not able to identify, or sorry, I apologize, he's outside the gas station, mm-hmm. sees the same thing out of the same car.
So, the evidence relating to the event itself, as you would describe it then, let me just see if I can summarize it. So, McLilly undisputedly goes into the convenience store unmasked.
Yes.
He's on the video. He admits that in his own testimony,
yes.
Right?
Not to interrupt, Your Honor, but
yeah, that's
he
right.
calls the investigating officer when his picture is put out on the news. He calls the investigating officer and says, why is my picture out on the news? And that's the picture of him going unmasked into the convenience store before the robbery.
Okay. All right. So he goes into the convenience store unmasked. The three young men say, so he comes out, and then the three young men say, after he comes out, he asks them, same guy, McLilly, to go in and drop a bottle, right?
Yes.
And there, he McLilly at that in that conversation is sitting inside something like a blue Chevy or
blue
300.
Or black Chevy.
And then the young men say that McLilly, that three guys get out of that same vehicle, one of them with a weapon. Now they're masked and they go in. And the young men run away.
I believe they say one or two. I think one witness says one, the other one.
Okay.
The other two say two, yes.
All right. And then you have Singh, who, you know, admittedly under extremely difficult circumstances, makes this, you know, thinks he can make this identification. That's pretty much the body of your evidence to the effect that this error was not prejudicial. Is that fair?
Well, I'd also add in the boots that were seized at the preliminary examination. So McLilly wears these boots to the prelim. The officer says those look like the boots on the video of the assailant. He seizes those, and then those boots and then a picture of the assailant wearing boots are submitted to the jury for their analysis and comparison.
I mean, boots in Michigan and December or whatever. But
well, there was testimony by the officer that the reason he thought those boots were the same boots from that video was there was a distinctive strap on the top of the boots, a brown strap that he noticed.
Okay.
And so that was pointed out to the jury as well. And then again, there was a photograph of the boots and then the boots themselves submitted as evidence. I do think Singh's testimony is very compelling. He obviously is the one who was shot. He's pleading for his life. He's shot by somebody. He identifies that person as McLilly. And then he's cross-examined by defense counsel quite extensively about this mask issue and how could you remember this? It was in the heat of the moment. And he stands up to the cross-examination. He adamantly maintains that this is the person that shot me. It's McLilly. He says it's the eyes and the forehead that he remembers, but he says this is the person
that
shot me.
Yeah, I'm sure that was pretty gripping in the courtroom.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. And I know he was in quite a lot of pain when he was testifying as well, and even at sentencing he was still in pain from the issue. Mm-hmm. But I think all of that is maintain is where the...
So that's the evidence that sort of, you know, renders harmless in your view.
You can certainly see how a jury deliberating, listening to the defendant's argument as to why taking apart the pieces of evidence, they really can't rely on it, and how eyewitness testimony can often be problematic. The fact that you could see somebody one time and then get confused about that identification and the identification of the actual shooter and all of that, and then be deliberating and sort of say, yeah, but you know, the police officer, they're professionals. He said it's the same guy.
I have 2 points in response to that. First of all, the jury was instructed that the police officer testimony is to be given the same weight as any other witness, and jurors are presumed to follow their instructions. But secondly, and probably more importantly in this case, the jury got to be their own eyewitness. The jury was given the surveillance video to look at, was given these still frame photographs of Mr. McLilley coming in beforehand, and then the assailant afterwards coming in with a gun, with a mask on. And the photo of, and I believe this was submitted to the court upon the court's request, the photo of the assailant, the mask is like a surgical mask. It's not a full mask. It's not covering the entire face. It's basically just across the mouth. So the jury got to look at that and make this determination on their own. I think that's the most compelling evidence for the jury.
So we inquired about the video. No one can find it. Is that?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, yeah.
Okay, and then on the pictures, I believe that we got only the picture with the mask. Are you saying that we also got a picture of him coming in without a mask?
No, I believe there were two pictures requested by the court. I think it's Exhibits 167 and 181, and they were both of people masked. So those are the two the court has.
Are there exhibits of him without a mask?
I believe there are. I didn't reach out to figure out if they had all of those exhibits, but I do believe there are. I believe it's Exhibits 167 through 180, or maybe 167 through 182, are all pictures, still frame photographs from the robbery itself. And I believe in there are masked and unmasked.
Can we get all these photographs you're talking about?
I can absolutely reach out to the county and see.
Is that
if
okay?
I can.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'll obviously.
I mean, why don't you all work together? I mean, Helene, do you want to specify what?
No, because we just asked the clerk's office for the video, and we got these two photos. I don't know exactly what they asked for, but I think it would be helpful if we saw what there was.
Okay.
And it's my recollection from the transcript that 167 through, I believe, 182 were all admitted at the same time, and they were these photographs of the, I believe, petitioner coming in initially unmasked, and then also the assailants coming in with masks on. So I could reach out and try to get all that group of photos.
If you jointly can provide us with what you know you think is responsive to Judge White.
Obviously, only what was introduced into.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. And I apologize if there was a misunderstanding on my part about what photographs were requested. I apologize for that. I just thought it was the two.
You know, on one legal question, as I understand it, you're saying that under Davenport, we must do, for harmlessness, both a Brecht and a deferential Chapman review?
That's correct.
But the state court itself didn't do a Chapman review. There's nothing like a Chapman review there.
In terms of harmlessness?
Correct.
As to the constitutional issue.
Yeah, it didn't do a Chapman qua Chapman review. It did, it never ostensibly reached the federal constitutional issue. It's one of these odd cases where they just sort of just don't even say anything about it.
Well, I believe, actually, looking back at the appellate filings in state court, I don't believe the petitioner ever raised.
I know, but you didn't argue that in your brief.
And I understand that. I'm just
they can waive that. So I'm assuming that's waived for purposes of my question.
I do not believe. Yeah, we did not.
I understand what Davenport says, but we have nothing by way of a Chapman determination to defer to here, unless I'm missing something.
No, and I guess I'm not trying to raise the procedural default this 11th hour. I guess I'm just explaining why the state appellate court didn't do it, is it was never asked to approach the constitutional issue. It was always under state law.
I see, and that's fine. You know, I mean, then we're left with Brecht. But, I mean, can we agree then, I mean, just again, for purposes of sort of narrowing disagreement, that our review would just be under Brecht, because there just isn't a Chapman determination for us to be deferential toward.
I don't know if I would agree with that. I think that the harmlessness analysis done by the trial court pretty much subsumes the constitutional issue. I mean, it's
not really. I mean, isn't the state court determination, in a sense, as Justice Alito put it, less protective than the federal? I mean, the state standard is, but for this, the guy's acquitted, right? And then the Chapman standard is much more protective of a criminal defendant. Beyond a reasonable doubt, we're confident that this did not affect it. I mean, that's, so Chapman's more, better for Mr. McLilley, and so they're applying a standard that's more favorable to the prosecution. It's just a different, it's not a Chapman determination.
And I'd agree with that. They're differing. Obviously, one is more protective than the other. I think under either standard, he loses.
No, I understand that. Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, figure out what we need to address and what we don't.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I see my time is out, unless the court
has one other question on the sentencing issue.
Yes.
What's your quick response to the fact that the judge made this finding of fact that substantially increased the sentence?
Yeah, I think, and I don't want to parrot too much of the brief, I think it's harmless for two reasons. One, it's harmless because the trial court in the motion for relief from judgment indicated that the sentence would not be changed. I know there's some quibbling about this armed robbery issue, but if you look at the motion for relief from judgment and you look at the opinion, the court clearly is addressing offense variable 6 as it applies to assault with intent to commit murder. And in fact, under the Michigan sentencing guidelines, offense variable 6 cannot be even scored for an armed robbery. The statute is clear. It can only be scored for a homicide, attempted homicide, solicitation, or conspiracy to commit homicide offense. So we still maintain that armed robbery notation at the end of the motion for relief from judgment, where the court says, in any event, we wouldn't have changed our sentence on the armed robbery, they meant the assault with intent to murder. I think they had to have meant the assault with intent to murder.
The court doesn't say wouldn't have changed. Wouldn't have been, what did the court say, substantially different?
Substantially affected or substantially different, which I take to mean they wouldn't have changed it. I mean, also considering that on the armed robbery, they went above guidelines and sentenced to 40 to 60 years. So I think it's fair to reason they're not going to change the sentencing in this case, even with the guidelines being advisory. And the second point I made, and it's also made in the brief, is that it's still harmless because even using the jury found facts, the jury would have had to have found to convict of assault with intent to murder that there was an intent to kill, commit great bodily harm, or callous disregard for harm or death. That would put the OV6 scoring at 25 points instead of 50. And when those guidelines are put in place under that formulation, the sentence still falls within the guidelines range. So advisory, mandatory, whichever, even using only facts that would have been found by the jury, this sentence is still within the guideline range. So I think it's harmless either way you strike. I do note that this court, the second reason it's harmlessness, this court recently just remanded a case, Evans v. Rewerts, for the same issue. It was in a lien scoring, but if you took away the judge found fact and looked only at the jury found facts, the sentence was still within the guideline range. This court remanded back to the district court to determine if that was harmless error. And I have the cite if the court wishes.
So on the sentencing issue as well, we're doing a Brecht analysis. I'm not trying to repeat that. I'm just saying that's the nature of what we're doing
there. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll hear rebuttal.
If I can, just briefly. Regarding the first issue when it comes to the constitutional error and identification, I think Judge White hit the nail on the head. One thing that should be pointed out about those three juveniles is that the amount of time that's alleged that they saw Mr. McLilley, he obviously admits that he went to the store to buy items. He says he came out and left. These juveniles contend that he walked by them, got into a vehicle, and drove up and made a couple of statements to them with a window partially down, only partially down, per the testimony of Robinson. And I think it's important to note the facts, additionally, that Mr. McLilley testified when he saw a photograph on the news. He also had officers that had come to his home, and he's the one that reached out to the police saying, hey, what is going on here? Why are you looking at me? So,
how about the testimony from some of these young people that the assailants come out of that same vehicle. I mean, that would be especially damaging, it would seem.
I can understand that. The testimony is that the juveniles are standing at the gas station outside. They see a vehicle that's in a completely different position, parked at a pump, and the person that's purportedly the driver. People get out, and then they take off. So we're dealing with a matter of moments here that these people are saying the same car, a Chevy, whether it's blue. The testimony from our client is that it was black. So I understand the court's point when it comes to the damning evidence, but we have to look at the time period as well that goes into the issues with eyewitness identification.
Okay.
And I apologize, I did not greatly discuss the Aline issue. And I think necessarily in this instance, I know the government is arguing that the in the motion for relief from judgment, Judge Fullerton indicated that she would not have changed her sentence when it comes to the armed robbery. And this was after an analysis previously as to the fact that she exceeded the guidelines without giving substantial and compelling reasons to, as she needed to under state law at the time. I don't think we can say, and a constitutional violation when you necessarily have judicially found facts and mandatory guidelines at the time, that it's a typo, and as such is harmless. Obviously, courts speak through their orders, and as I indicated, the judge was previously addressing the armed robbery conviction at length, and we're dealing with one sentence. I would have sentenced the same on the armed robbery, and we're dealing with the assault.
What was the mandatory floor at the time of sentencing? I mean, the Michigan guidelines were mandatory at that time.
Correct. Right?
And so what was the floor that the district court had for a sentence? He got 40 years.
He got 40 years. And with the guidelines being mandatory, if I can, I believe the guidelines as scored at the trial court on the assault with intent to murder with that additional scoring of the points were 225 to 750.
Months?
Months on the minimum. Obviously, we're not dealing with a 2 years flat. There's a felony firearm that's consecutive and proceeding. So in addition to that, and especially when we're dealing with, you know, a sentence of 45 years where Mr. McLilly is 38 years old at the time of the sentence and his earliest release date will be when he's 86 years old. The 50 points.
But the judge goes way above the floor.
She does, absolutely. The floor of the 225. The guidelines range the bottom to the minimum. The floor.
I mean, so this is like a federal case where, say, before Aline, the district court makes a finding that triggers, say, a 10-year mandatory minimum, and the judge ends up giving him, say, 22 years, and says, "I would do that." It briefly says, "I would do that even without the mandatory minimum."
I agree. Yes, that's our argument. I would note that.
But I mean,
to go above or below, so, there has to be substantial and compelling reasons per the Michigan.
Right. But I query whether that hurts you. I mean, the question here is whether we have grave doubt.
Correct.
We have grave doubt as to whether the trial judge would have sentenced him below had that floor not been where it is. And sometimes, you know, they might be sentencing in relation to the floor to some extent. Like a higher floor encourages them to go higher. But I mean, why do you think we should, given that the judge seemed to, you know, kind of not be restrained or not feel compelled at all by that floor, why do you think we ought to have grave doubt about the sentence?
Well, and to begin with, because of the language in the order that's specifically written that says it's the armed robbery and not the assault with intent to murder. And if you take those guideline range, and even conceding the government's point that under the assault with intent to murder, the judge found facts instead of 50 points for the scoring of OV6, it may be more like 25. You're still dealing with sentencing guidelines of around 171 to 570. So I think the grave doubt comes into play when you have the mandatory nature of the guidelines. There's no consideration when it comes to the relation of the floor, et cetera, as to how Judge Fullerton actually decided to sentence Mr. McLilley to that 45 years and just a simple dismissive line that I wouldn't change it for armed robbery.
All right. Any further questions? All right. Thank you both for your arguments.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted. Much.